Welcome back to Between Two Wings. I'm your host, Emily Norman, and today we have Bill McGlynn with us, who started off as a donor and is now the president of the Recreational Aviation Foundation. They're an organization who aims to preserve, improve, and create recreational and backcountry airstrips. Bill, thank you so much for coming on our show today.
Pleasure to be here, Emily.
Yeah, and so we like to start off by talking about our backgrounds. I knew you were going to come today with some amazing, incredible, you know, backcountry strip. So I had to find maybe a nice sunset picture. I definitely don't have as much experience as you, but, you know, although it is a commercial airliner, the clouds, sunset, wing view, we still love it. So all good there. But tell us a little bit about what you got behind you.
Well, it looks like we were on a sunset theme.
There you go. You know, yeah.
It's the competition who could get the best yellow and orange going on together.
Yeah, for sure.
This place is my favorite place on the planet. It's called Moose Creek, Idaho. It's One Uniform One is the designator. And it's 50 miles from the nearest light bulb. It's way back up in the Idaho wilderness, kind of in the central part of Idaho. It's a beautiful place. The Forest Service created it as a ranger district. In fact, it's one of the oldest ranger districts in the country. And it was mainly used for firefighting back in the 30s and the 40s. And now it's used for recreation. And it's one of the places that we put a lot of emphasis to take care of. A lot of pilots, you know, really love this place and come here often.
Yeah, I can definitely see why. I think I'm going to go favor that in four flight right after we talk. And one day, maybe I'll get there. So thank you for inspiring me there.
I might be there.
Yeah. Perfect. We can meet up and then we can also have another sunset photo challenge. See who wins next time.
Exactly.
So I know you always wanted to get into aviation and fly, but you didn't get into it until later in life. And then finally, you found your passion for backcountry flying. Take us through that a little bit.
I think I'm like so many other people that had the hook set when they were really young. I got a ride with a guy when I was 13. He actually let me fly the airplane. I couldn't believe I was flying the airplane. Set the hook so deep that all my life, I just would hear an airplane go over and look up, you know. But you know how it is. It's like when you're young, you don't have the money. When you finally have the money, you have kids and a family and all those things kind of collaborated and, you know, and a real busy career. All those things kind of collaborated to work against me for my flying, my personal flying career. I actually put in about 3 million miles on the back of United Airlines, flying all the way around the world multiple times during my work career, which kind of, you know, it's just not enough. But finally, midlife, if you will, 45, I finally said, this is it. If I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And I committed to it and I got it done. And it's been just a great chapter in my life.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I honestly love about aviation. There isn't a lot of age discrimination. You can have that dream and passion at any age and hop into it. But so you got your private and, you know, flying around. What led you to flying to some of the beautiful places like you have behind you?
I think that's also kind of a common story. As you know, I got in the cockpit, I soloed, I was able to fly around by myself, and my instructor was worried that I was going to set a new record for the student that lasts the longest before the check ride. And so I was having such a great time just flying around that I didn't need a check ride. And he finally forced me to do it. And so I learned in tail draggers, but I couldn't find a DPE, a designated pilot examiner, that was checked out in a tailwheel airplane. So I had to start flying nosewheel airplanes just to get checked off. And once I did that, it was like the world was my oyster. I mean, I was flying around to different airports. I went to multiple places for breakfast, as you probably have done. You know, and the path became a little bit too worn. In fact, the one place I wanted to go for breakfast was this place called Sulphur Creek Ranch, which is in the, it's very, very southwest corner of one of the wildernesses in Idaho, which is the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. Sulphur Creek Ranch is just this incredible place to go. And they happen to serve a fantastic breakfast. So at any rate, I wanted to go there. I knew I had to get some backcountry training to do this because the airstrip there is about as wide as the, you know, the breadth of one tire to the other tire on a 182.
Yeah.
So no room for error, in other words, right? So I started getting backcountry training then, but I really felt like right after I learned to fly, that was like chapter one of just flying pavement to pavement. And then chapter two, where it got better for me, was flying in the mountains, getting confidence in being able to fly down narrow canyons without seeing an airstrip in the windscreen. And doing things that just gave you a sense, not only the sense of freedom of being able to do something like that, because that is one of the big rewards, but the sense of accomplishment that it's like, wow, I can really fly this airplane really slowly, and I could do it really, really carefully and safely. I can even take people with me, and I can land where I need to land. And then the best part is you get out and go, holy cow, look where we are.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you know, touching a little bit about that, like how does backcountry flying and the training and all those processes help you become a better pilot overall?
I think it's a lot like driving a car. You know, I'll bet you when you go to work, you're probably able to have a cup of coffee in your left hand. Your phone is probably sitting in a cradle because I know you're a really safe person. And but you can mess around with the radio, and you can do all those things while you're traveling at, you know, plus 60 miles an hour down the road within feet of other vehicles, right? And we take that for granted because it's all built into muscle memory by now. I think that's the goal, is that you got to get the airplane into muscle memory where you don't even think about what you need to do in order to move the airplane one direction or the other, or slow it down, or, you know, and one of the problems people have in the backcountry is they make approaches way too fast because they're terrified of stalling the airplane below the trees. But the point of it is that when you really build enough time and skills and you get help doing that, it all becomes muscle memory at a point, and you don't even really think about what you're doing, but you're slowing the airplane down naturally. You're starting to, you know, apply flaps and other things while you're looking at the runway, checking your airspeed, doing all those things, listening to the radio. And it all comes very naturally. I think that's when you know radio. And it all comes very naturally. I think that's when you know you've kind of arrived. And you're a better pilot for it, no question. Just like IFR skills builds a better pilot. But being able to keep the airplane at a certain airspeed while the rocks are going by 10 feet off your wingtip, that's a skill that you know, that it takes time and patience to really develop it and get really, really good at it. I don't think it's a 10,000 hour thing, like you know, like playing the cello. It is. If I played the cello, it would be 20. Okay. So, but
there you go. Same here. Don't worry.
Yeah, same here. I don't think it's a 10,000 hour thing, but I do think it's, there's time there, and you need to build the skills, and you need to be able to test yourself as you're going forward so that you realize what your abilities are. We talk about this a lot with the AOPA, you know, Air Safety Institute. Richard McSpadden and I have been working on this backcountry safety initiative. And that's been the biggest part of the topic, is how do you get a pilot to feel like the airplane is part of their anatomy? You know, it's an extension of their arms and legs and brain. That's what you should be able to do.
Yeah, that's great. And kind of touching on that, you talked a little bit about, you know, those solo moments and the first cross country and then getting up to backcountry flying. Those are all big and kind of stressful and emotional moments. And you had mastered, you know, the stick and rudder skills, but then you're playing it in these very small spaces. What was that first experience like?
You know, I'm not sure I could even hear the radio because of my heart pounding in my ears. And I just remember when I finally got the airplane off the runway and, you know, kind of positioned or parked, and shut the engine down and got out, I took this huge gasp of air, and because I don't think I'd been breathing probably for about the last, you know, 5 or 6 minutes. And that gasp of air was just filled with the smell of pine. And now when I smell pine like that, it has this aura about it that it takes my brain back to that time. And it was like, that was such an invigorating moment, you know, to realize I can do this. I can do this safely. And I did that really well, you know, and there are things that I'll improve next time, but I did do that well. And so the sense of accomplishment is tremendous. People that just do touch and goes, I always feel sorry for them because it's like, wow, you're really missing out on the moment. It's like, you're already racing to the next moment. You could get out of the airplane, you know, stand there for a few minutes, maybe even pull out a chair and just cherish, you know, the last few minutes, you know, replay it in your head. They say that's what tennis players do all the time, right? That's how they become so great, is that they play moments in their mind. And that's the reason that when they go out and play, they're able to repeat those moments. So I think even from a training aspect, but they're missing out on just these magnificent moments of accomplishment.
For sure. And so RAF obviously has aligned very much with, you know, your passions and your goals. How did you get started in this organization?
I remember reading an article, and I remember it was in 2010. And the article was basically about how all these backcountry airstrips were being threatened and were being taken off the charts. Just because they weren't being used as much, and the public land managers that belong to places like the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service, their budgets were continually being crunched, you know, so they had to make choices. And because they weren't hearing from the pilot community that much, they thought that's a decent choice, right? Pilot organizations would stand up and scream about something, but then they would relax, you know, thinking, okay, we made our voice heard. It's like it took more than that. So I so identified with the logic of all of that and the difficulty of it. I wrote them a check, you know, and then when I retired, I still felt so strongly about it that I thought I'm going to personally get involved. I don't know exactly what I can contribute, but I'm going to start helping. The RAF started out as, you know, six people, you know, who agreed that they needed to do something. And now it's almost 10,000. And it's just like-minded pilots who all think that we need to cherish these places, but you can't just love them. You have to do things